This is Indie Book Publishing. Indie Book Publishing is a show about new books and the authors who wrote them. It's an opportunity for prospective readers to hear directly from the writers, to hear what inspired them to write and publish, and to hear all the inside details about their books. And now, Indie Book Publishing with your host, Steve Jorgensen.
The title of the book, My Journal, My Friend, A Journey of Self-Discovery and Inspiration. And the author is Kelly Lee Jackson and co-contributor Caroline Schar. They both join us now on Indie Book Publishing, this special interview brought to you by Balboa Press. Hello, Kelly Lee.
Hello, Steve.
Hi, Carolyn.
Hi, Steve.
Well, this is great not only to have you with us to explain the benefits of having a journal and your great guidance for young people, and hopefully families get involved as well. And we're all brought together all the way. We're bringing Texas and Australia together.
We are.
The magic of technology, and it's wonderful. So let me read a couple things that have been written about the book, and so everyone understands the focus that you have so skillfully accomplished. You say this: My Journal, My Friend, A Journey of Self-Discovery and Inspiration is a guided journal that will help you take control of your life and claim responsibility for your own choices, to feel empowered by your ability to choose. Writing down your innermost thoughts and emotions helps you to express your feelings and to figure things out. And boy, that is a big, big challenge, to figure things out, especially when you're a teenager, right?
That's right, yes.
Absolutely.
Kelly Lee, why don't we start with you? Tell us a little bit about you, your background, and why you decided to write the book, and then we'll bring Carol in to do the same. Go ahead, Kelly Lee.
I'm an at-home mum and a wife, and I've got three children. And I guess our children and the experiences of our own childhood actually inspired us to create this journal. And what we're hoping is that we're hoping to ease the confusion and anxiety and the general challenges that are related to being a teenager. And what we really wanted to do was to reach out to teens who feel as we did, those that feel awkward or unconfident, bullied and frustrated, and empower them to take control of their life through their own choices. We hope to give them the self-confidence necessary to be able to cope with the ups and downs of life by changing the way that they view and they respond to the challenges that life inevitably delivers, and enabling them to thrive and become well-balanced individuals, to be their best selves. And I guess Caroline and I, we wholeheartedly believe in the practice of journaling because we know firsthand that it helped us. We were able to escape the downward spiral of depression simply because it permitted us the invaluable opportunity to express our innermost thoughts and feelings about our own troubles when we were growing up. And later on, when we were actually able to combine journaling with reading inspirational books, our lives, they would just change forever. And then once we've had kids of our own, it really put into perspective what's important in life. And so we set about creating a journal which we hope would one day help our own children and potentially help us to fulfill a dream of our own of helping others to escape the treadmill of self-doubt and depression and simply bring out the best in others.
Well, Caroline, why don't you add to that?
Mm-hmm. Yes, our main message is to teenagers is that we were there once too, and we understand what it feels like to go through difficulties. And the tendency when you're a teenager is to withdraw. And the main thing that we wanted to teach is that we learned through difficulty to withdraw into our strengths. That's not something that you can do very easily. It's something that you learn to do, and we learn to do it through journaling. So you can easily withdraw into your own room when you're a teenager and withdraw into self-pity or depression or negative thoughts or listening to what other people are saying to you, or you can go into your room and in the quiet you can withdraw into that little voice, that strength that slowly comes out as you practice more positive choices or just a more positive way of looking at yourself, of thinking about yourself. Mm. So that's our main message, that it's just through that daily quiet practice of doing that you can really overcome some of life's bigger challenges.
And Kelly Lee, in today's technological world where teenagers have so many gadgets to occupy their time, this kind of breaks that cycle, doesn't it? Gets them into the real meaning of life.
It sure does. And I mean, today, actually physically writing in a journal would be, you know, some might consider antiquated. And okay, sure, this is a process that you could actually extend to doing on a computer. But that physical process of actually writing down your thoughts and emotions, that cathartic, very therapeutic process, focuses consciously on your thoughts, emotions and experiences, and it enables you to express them with honesty, because you don't have to worry about what other people are thinking or judging you or, you know, criticizing what you're saying. It just enables you to have control that's otherwise lacking. When you're writing down what's really going on, whatever is stressing you, it's actually shown to improve your mental health and your sense of well-being, because it's enabling you to work through issues, not to just focusing on your computer and all the distractions that are going on there, and your phone too. It doesn't enable you to just stop and concentrate on what is really bothering you or what things you need to work through in your life to move forward and progress to a happier place and be living a life that is feeling more fulfilling.
Well, what I love about this book, your journal, My Journal, My Friend, it's not just a bunch of empty pages. It actually is a guided journal, as you put it. And you give some direction, you give some philosophy, some ideas, and then you help them, you prompt them. That is a very, very different approach. You prompt them with maybe a little question or an open-ended statement, right?
Yes, we do.
Absolutely.
Yes. And it's hoped that just those little prompts will be the impetus to get them really thinking on a deeper level about what's actually happening in their life. Because no matter what is going on in your life, and even though when you're a teenager and you feel like you've got so many rules and everything placed upon you, you still have choices to make every day within those limitations. So no matter whether you're feeling oppressed by having rules and things put upon you at school by your teachers or your parents, or even if it's your peers and the people at school that are giving you perhaps a tough time or trying to steer you in a certain direction, each and every day you have a choice about where your life is headed. And what we're trying to emphasise is exactly that, that you still have choices. So even when teens feel like, well, I don't have a choice, I'm told what to do all the time, well, actually, they have a choice about whether they're going to choose happiness and to choose to follow a positive direction in life, or whether they're just going to go with whatever stream that they're in at school or however they're being directed by their parents. So, yeah, we're just hoping that something within the journal will trigger that that idea that they are empowered by their ability to choose and to feel really positive and grateful for having those choices.
Caroline, how will My Journal, My Friend help parents?
Absolutely, yes. The book appeals to parents of teenagers because it touches on a lot of the topics that are difficult to open up. So topics such as teen sex, drugs and alcohol, And we have another topic in there called When the Going Gets Tough, which is really looking at when life is really getting tough and teenagers starting to think about, the dreaded word of suicide or just generally going down that path or even thinking about that. So that's where it helps parents. It opens up the conversation between them and their child, and also gives them some practical measures about how they can open that conversation with their teenager and how they can direct them to start those important conversations. So it does offer, it is for teenagers, but it subtly provides an adult perspective on these range of issues.
Yes, this guided journal, again, has instruction, inspiration, and then these open-ended statements, and of course some blank pages where the teenager then can express themselves in hopefully in very deep ways. Now let's talk about some of these topics, Kelly Lee. For example, of course, a very important one. You've touched on it a little bit. Self-worth.
Yes. So each of the topics that are included are there to get them thinking in another way. And self-worth, what that goes over is thinking about things like how you talk, your inner dialogue, how you speak to yourself, how you consider yourself, because it affects, those things affect the choices that you make in life and therefore the direction that you take in life. So if you've got a good, healthy sense of self-worth, you're going to consider the direction that you're going in life. You're going to, even though you might have peer group pressure or pressures upon you to take a certain direction in life, if you've got a strong sense of self-worth and you are going to choose what is right for you, and you are going to stop and think about how you know those choices are right for you, because you're concentrating on whether or not you're in a positive state of mind and you feel excited about what you're doing in life, or whether you're just following the crowd, basically. And that's where I think kids end up into a lot of trouble these days, because they're just not thinking about the ultimate outcome of the choices that they're making. So the bottom line is that if we have kids that have got a good sense of self-worth, they are going to be more likely to stand up to peer group pressure, and instead of just going along with that peer group pressure, because it's the easy thing to do.
Other topics for contemplation each month, as you put it, growing pains, relax, life is full of choices. Caroline, tell us about this one, When the Going Gets Tough. Teenagers don't want things to be tough. I don't think adults do either, but boy, we need to train them early, don't we?
We do. And basically, When the Going Gets Tough, the topic talks about those times in life where you can't feel positive. You try, but nothing seems to work, and what you can do in those times. And we have a range of tools or tips for when those moments come, and whether that message is simply that this will pass, and sharing that thought on that particular day that, yes, it feels bad right now, but it will pass. And for all you know, the best is yet to come. The best is ahead of you. And if you can just wait out this time, things will turn around. And very gently and slowly you can turn those tough times around. So it's just reassuring teens that when things do feel really bad, and when they're feeling as though nothing they do is going to work, those are the times where they need to stop, breathe, spend that time on their own, feeling what they're feeling, but knowing that it will pass, that there's more out there for them. And the journal, that's why we've called it My Journal, My Friend, because it's in those times that they need that friend to be there with them all the time. So we're hoping that the journal will provide that ongoing support and friendship, especially during those tough times.
Other topics, setting goals, empathy, Kelly Lee, we've got about a minute. Why don't you talk about gratitude, a powerful state of mind?
Yes, gratitude and realizing all the gifts that you have in your life right now. I mean, it doesn't matter how elaborate or how simple that your life is, there's always something to be grateful for. So it's reaching for what is positive in your life and what is positive about life that will help you to make positive choices and to feel good about yourself and feel good about the potential of your own life. So I think it's gratitude and especially empathy. If you don't mind me touching on empathy quickly, empathy is just an enormous issue that we really need to think about in this day and age, because we find ourselves in a situation where we've got ridiculous cases of bullying and teens getting bashed up and all sorts of things happening, which it feels like it's a downward spiral, and it must be just dreadful for people that are actually living in those situations or know somebody that is actually living in that situation. And if we all had empathy, where we're able to look at try and put ourselves in another person's shoes, then we would have that those incidences would either not occur at all, or it'd be a huge reduction in the amount of incidences. So I think that having gratitude for the wonderful life that we all have and the ability that we have to choose in our life, and also looking at how we are affecting people around us and having empathy for how we are treating others and just trying to be the best people that we can be, that can only lead to living a far more fulfilling and happy life.
The title of the book, My Journal, My Friend, A Journey of Self-Discovery and Inspiration, and the author is Kelly Lee Jackson with co-contributor Caroline Schar. Kelly Lee, tell us how to get your book.
You can get our book through Balboa, or you can get it through Amazon or Barnes & Noble. So if you just have a look on the net, you'll be able to find it.
Well, thank you both for being with us on Indie Book Publishing, this special interview brought to everyone by Balboa Press. Thank you, Kelly Lee.
Thank you so much for having us. Thank you for your time, Steve.
Thank you, Caroline.
And Merry Christmas to everyone, too. Sorry.
Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you.
Merry Christmas to you as well, and a great, great book to help us, especially start this new year. Thank you, Vo. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to Indie Book Publishing, and we'll be right back after these messages.
Get ready to live La Bella Vita with Dawn Catherine on Toginet.com. Live La Bella Vita. If you're wanting to know all the beauty tricks of the trade and the latest fashion trends before everyone else, this is your show. If you admire celebrities' beauty and their fashion sense, this is your show. Do you love wine and want to know more about the process it takes to make wine from the vine to the bottle? This is your show. Live La Bella Vita. For more on the show and your host, check out our website, labellavitacosmetico.com. This is the kind of show you can sink your teeth into. If you enjoy traveling and food and family, all with an Italian flair, then you can live La Bella Vita with your host, Dawn Catherine. Wednesday nights at midnight, 11 p.m. Central on toginet.com.
Mark Lipinski is coming to TogiNet. It's Creative Mojo with Mark Lipinski. A live two-hour show Wednesday afternoon starting at 3, 2 Central on TogiNet.com. Creative Mojo. It's fun, entertaining, informative, inspirational, and illuminating. Lipinski has worked on such shows as Oprah, The View, The Joan Rivers Show, and Ricky Lake. He's busy, but he's got the drive to share with Creative Mojo, dedicated to the modern crafter and crafting lifestyle. Dive into the info and enjoy everything from celebs to entertainment news to recipes, quilting and needlework,
knitting, painting, woodworking, Christmas crafts, and so much more. This show boldly encourages you to discover and harness your own creative spirit by living creatively every day. For more on Mark and the show, check out marklipinski.com. Don't miss the fun. It's Creative Mojo with Mark Lipinski, Wednesday afternoon starting at 3, 2 Central on toginet.com.
Welcome back to Indie Book Publishing, helping authors publish, promote, and sell their books around the world. Now, back to your host, Steve Jorgensen.
The title of the book, I Fought the Lord, and the Lord Won, a memoir. And the author is James W. Anderson, and James joins us now on Indie Book Publishing, this interview brought to you by Westbow Press. Hello, Jim.
Hello, Steve. How are you?
Well, great to have you with us. This is your story, as you say, a memoir, and it has a great ending. That's what's great about this story. You see and you understand from your experiences, and of course, we all have experiences. Some of us never learn, but you apparently have. And of course, you've written this book. Let me just read a couple things. You've written, just to set the stage, you say, as a memoir, it's about my life's journey. It wasn't until later in life, after two brushes with death, did I fully comprehend how significant my paternal grandfather's influence on me happened to turn out. And I tell how my life took several improbable twists and turns in the wild goose chase and went on to discover something that was totally unexpected. Often the unexpected opens our eyes. Is that what happened here?
Yes, no question about it, Steve. It's, as you said, it's my memoir. It's my life's journey from childhood through to today, where I'm almost 60. And during that process, I learned that life just simply isn't always fair. In fact, sometimes bad things even happen to good people. And if we can learn to accept the bad things with a positive attitude, it can become a chain reaction for positive thoughts, events, and outcomes. Something negative can become a catalyst that sparks extraordinary results. And I was fearful that I would never be able to share with my grandchildren the eyewitness account that my paternal grandfather shared with me. His teachings were a sound foundation, and because of my bad health, I was afraid I might never get the opportunity to do for my grandchildren what my grandfather did for me. I had what I call a come to Jesus call when I was 56 years old, actually on my 56th birthday, and felt compelled to share my calling with others that I know and love.
When you were 18, you had your first brush with death.
I probably was pushing things too hard and burning the candle on both ends, and I ended up with acute meningitis and encephalitis, and went into a brief coma, and while I was in that coma, I recognized the voice of the minister who confirmed me reading the 23rd Psalm, and for Lutherans, that's the equivalent of last rites for Catholics, and it scared the death out of me. I described that situation in the book, but I didn't, regretfully, I didn't take heed then. I let several decades pass until I finally recognized it for what it was.
Now, you say that through those years until you were 56, when you had two massive strokes, and you believed in your Creator, but you failed to embrace the reality that Jesus was truly the Son of God in human form. What was the struggle there?
Well, you know, it's odd. Lots of people don't turn to God until they need something. And I needed something when I was 18, but I didn't turn to him for it. I didn't recognize it for what it was. And, you know, usually by that time, it's too late for a miracle to occur. Having a daily conversation with God so he knows where you are and what you need versus what you want, I believe will create a space for God right there in the middle between your needs on one hand and your wants on the other. There'll be a space there for God to perform miracles in your life. And sometimes, on the other hand, he might place a call to you, like he did when I was in the coma when I was in high school. And if he does, all I say is, for everybody's sake, pick up the phone and say hello.
Yeah, when God calls, answer the call, right?
Yes, sir, indeed.
Well, you've learned a number of things, and that's what your book is about. And you also share what you learned from your grandfather, and then, of course, what you learned on your own.
Yeah, for sure. And I was blessed to have such a spiritual leader in my grandfather. My book is for skeptical Christians everywhere, just like I had been. I had almost an idyllic childhood, but for some reason, unbeknownst to me, I allowed common day reasoning and intellect to trump what I learned to be true from my family. And not until I had a near-death calling from the Lord on my 56th birthday did I understand my true purpose on earth. I took it upon myself to, based on that calling, to attempt to rewrite the Bible in 21st century prose so that my skeptical friends would be able to grasp the message and teachings in the Bible. I felt compelled to do that. That was a tall order, as I embarked on that, and I actually failed at that attempt miserably. My book provides an appendix that will help those who long to understand the nuance in the Bible better as a place to start, a better way for a skeptical intellect, if you will, to use the Bible as a reference guide, if you will, so that they can learn that the Bible is the source of answers for every question that faces mankind even today.
Well, and your book has two appendixes. Of course, the one you just talked about for struggling and skeptical Christians. And your second one, I guess, is your forum, your podium to talk about social issues facing America today.
Yeah, I kind of weave the two together. I've always been an opinionated person, and the second appendix is a summary of many op-eds that I've written over the years that were all published in local papers. They were, in my judgment, relevant op-eds on the problems that are facing the American people in the political arena today. And I tried to get them all published by the New York Times, and they take a look at it, and they hold it for a while, and they'd tell me, well, you're not free to publish this op-ed until we say yes or no with any other sources. And then a month would pass, and they'd come back, and they'd say, hey, you're free to publish it wherever you wanted. So I wanted to be on the big stage with the New York Times, but they rejected me in their own way. So I published them all locally, here in the Cincinnati Inquirer and other local papers. And the editors seemed to love them, and they embraced them. The sad part is almost all of my op-eds written in the last 20 years are still relevant in today's American political arena. And regretfully, our politicians in Washington, D.C., have taken no real serious interest in these matters. And regretfully, it's all part of their, as I describe, their need for self-centered, intolerant personal self-interests. And it's sad. So I kind of try and weave the two together, because in the final analysis, what I did was I wrote an op-ed for Jesus in the year 2011, and I justified it in as crisp of a form as I could. And it's the same thing that I experienced when I tried to rewrite the Bible in failed miserably. You know, I look at the 780,000 words in the Bible, and I tried to condense it down to a 90,000, a crisp, if you will, 90,000 word Tom Clancy type novel, and I failed at that task. But what it taught me from writing my op-eds over the years is that there's a way to convey a message using a minimum number of words straight on, head up, so that somebody doesn't just read paragraph one and stop. And that's what my op-eds did. And based on the life-threatening issue I had on my 56th birthday, I took the, as you called it, a wild goose chase turn to shift my efforts towards trying to help my skeptical Christian friends all over the world, and many of which, in fact, not only many, almost all of my friends, skeptical friends, are very bright individuals. They're intellects, and so I try to appeal to them on an intellectual plane. And I think anybody who struggles with how to have a meaningful conversation with somebody who's skeptical would find my book very beneficial.
And you have some very strong feelings about being a Christian, and some may say a bit controversial, because you say you learned that spending Sunday in church no more makes one a Christian than spending the rest of the week in a garage makes you a car. That's put in everyday, very blunt language.
Yeah, and so true it is. And I count myself as among those, because as a youngster, I was in church every Sunday. Not only was I in church, I turned the pages for our organist. I was an acolyte. I was an usher later. I was totally engaged, but I never quite grasped the fact, and I say emphasize fact, that Christ was the living Son of God in human form. I believed in my Creator, Steve, no question about it. All you have to do is step outside and look to the stars, and you know there's a higher power. But the reality that Jesus Christ came to earth in frail human form, I couldn't intellectually get my arms around that, even as a Christian. So, and I think the Lord recognized my suffering and wanted to use me as his messenger here on earth. And that's why I wrote the book. So I think it's a compelling read. And I know there are a lot of skeptical people out there. And if you count yourself among them, my book is, I believe, essential and also compelling.
And it's interesting how things occur in life. Things that maybe we don't think are very meaningful at the time, but many years ago, you read from the Houston Chronicle. You were returning to Harrisburg, and there was this featured story about Perlman, the Ishaq Perlman, the violinist who was giving a concert, and you just kept that with you, and you kept rereading it. Why?
Well, you know what? I really can't give you an honest-to-God answer for that. I couldn't my whole life. I took it as I moved. Every time I moved, I took that article with me, along with the front page of the Chicago Tribune the day Kennedy was assassinated, and the front page of the New York Times the day man landed on the moon. Those were just, they were markers in my lifetime. I had no idea what appealed to me about that article in the Houston Chronicle, except it must have been a harbinger of things to come, because as a result of my strokes, I ended up handicapped. I'm in a wheelchair. My mind came back, praise the Lord, and my legs, believe it or not, are coming back. And so I was struck by how he was able to overcome his handicap in a real troublesome situation. And that story is the first chapter of my book. And of course, I dedicate my book to struggling intellectual, people who have intellectual challenges or physical handicaps for whatever reason, just like Perlman.
Now, we have about a minute left. Jim, you feel a real obligation to pass on to the next generation to keep the truth alive, just like your grandfather helped you.
Yes, and that's the sad part. My grandfather gave me a real sound foundation. After my strokes, I was fearful I'd never be able to share my story with my grandchildren. I felt an obligation to share that story with them. And so it compelled me to write this book so that if something happens between now and when I have grandchildren, my legacy will live on for them through this book. They'll know me better, and they'll know the truth as I believe it to be, as their grandfather believed it to be, believes it to be, actually not believes, but knows it to be, because I want them, if I don't meet them on this earth, I want to spend eternity with them.
The title of the book, I Fought the Lord and the Lord Won, a memoir, and the author is James W. Anderson. Jim, tell us how to get your book.
Well, the easiest way would be to go to wespopress.com, and you can enter author equals James W. Anderson, and title, I Fought the Lord and the Lord Won, and it'll come up and they'll mail it to you in a matter of days. Alternatively, it's also available at Barnes & Noble, Amazon, and other retailers where you might already have a relationship and prefer to more easily obtain it there.
Well, thank you, Jim. This interview brought to everyone by Westbow Press. We appreciate you, Jim, being with us on Indie Book Publishing.
Thank you very much, Steve, and God bless.
You're listening to Indie Book Publishing, and we'll be right back after these messages. Want to be challenged in a powerful way to leap beyond what you think is possible? Then join us Mondays for the Leah Jansen Show, every Monday at 10 a.m., 9 a.m. Central on TogiNet.com with Leah Jansen. Listen live as life coach Leah uses her coaching skills to give you the tools you need to take action and create momentum. You are encouraged to call in and share your greatest fears, challenges, and obstacles, and then listen as Leah obliterates those barriers to success. For more on Leah and the show, check out her website, leahjansen.com. That's Leah, LEAHJANTZEN.com. Spend 1 hour with Leah, and you'll be captivated by her energy, enthusiasm, and magnetism. You'll quickly become addicted to her positive attitude and make-it-happen mentality. Ready for a life-changing, mood-altering show? Then get ready for Leah Jansen and listen live to The Leah Jansen Show every Monday morning at 10 a.m., 9 a.m. Central on TogiNet.com.
People think I've made it. I'm popular. I seem happy all the time. I have great clothes and I'm involved in everything. But I have questions, doubts, and fears, just like every other teenager. That's why I'm glad for Teen Talk Radio, where it's all about choices.
Join us for Teen Talk Radio with Nicole Odell, Thursday nights at 10, 9 central on TogiNet.com.
The choices we have to make that can alter the course of our lives. Life is too much pressure if we try to go it alone. I tune in to Teen Talk Radio with Nicole Odell every week to get reminded that I'm not alone. Nicole Odell is an expert on what happens in the lives of teenagers. Join her as she deals with topics like peer pressure, purity, drugs, alcohol, and many other things that might come up along the way. She writes books and speaks to people all over the place, but she says her favorite moments are when she can pull up a chair and chat with teens about what's important to us.
For more information on Nicole and her books, go to NicoleOdell.com. Then join us for Teen Talk Radio with Nicole Odell, Thursday nights at 10, 9 central on TogiNet.com.
Teen Talk Radio, where it's all about choices.
Welcome back to Indie Book Publishing, helping authors publish, promote, and sell their books around the world. Now, back to your host, Steve Jorgensen.
The title of the book, The House on Terminal Island, and the author is Ronald Schmidt. And Ron joins us now on Indie Book Publishing. This interview brought to you by Trafford Publishing. Hello, Ron.
Hi there.
Well, you're going to take us on quite a journey here. Most people might say this is a bit scary, but We're going to get into how you write these ghost stories, because it is much different than most, I'm sure.
It is.
And let me read, though, a little bit about this story. You say, this is a story that could happen to anyone, and what occurs at the end could be construed or considered demonic in nature. So we have a story here.
Very, very much so.
The house on Terminal Island that I know there's a couple of women move into this dream house, and the dream house turns into a nightmare, I guess.
Well, it's a divorced woman and her 17-year-old daughter and 15-year-old son actually live in a very poor, rundown neighborhood of Southern California, and through the luck of God, I guess, they actually hit the lotto, and she wins $100,000, which is enough to move her out of that area. So she and her family start looking for a house to buy, and they find this house that was built in the 60s it's a real island. Terminal Island lies between the cities of Long Beach and San Pedro, California, and it was used during World War II as a military training base, and now it's basically an actual terminal for freighters and so forth. But in my story, there's a section of the island that had homes built on it, and the beautiful views and nice homes, and she finds this one that's way underpriced. And the realtor says, I don't understand why it's so cheap, but look at it. It's a beautiful Victorian. And, you know, so anyway, they look at it and fall madly in love with it and think it's the home for them. And it's, you know, it's something that they're going to be happy in. Well, their first night there, she and the daughter are actually touched, and improperly touched, I should say. And both of them have a weird experience. The next morning they get up and compare stories, and from there it gets worse. The son's not bothered, but the touching gets worse, and it gets out to actually be sexual activity between the whatever it is and the divorced woman, and then her daughter is also bothered. And the story progresses to where things get really bad. She calls in investigators. They look over the house, and this one investigator knew the history of the house, and apparently what she didn't know and why it was priced so cheap was that it had a very bad history. First two families that moved into it were killed by family members who were possessed by something that was there. And she learns that there's demonic entities there that got there because at one time the home was rented by a demonic group that conjured up these entities. And it turns out that the house has got the demonic entities. It's also got a portal in one of the bedroom closets, which allows entities to come and go at will. So the house is just riddled with unwelcome kind of people. So eventually she moves out of the house, moves in with her mother in San Pedro, and then another demonic group comes in and investigates the property, and they make contact with everything that's there, and it turns out the demonic entities are planning something very big, because out of the portal is coming marching armies of demonic entities and helpers and so forth. So they know something big is going to happen. And as they're investigating the house, they call in an old retired priest, who the old retired priest has moved from Seattle down to Southern California area. And the head investigator calls this guy and asks for his help. He shows up, and he's immediately attacked by the demonic people and almost killed. And he finally says to the group, he says, you know, there's just nothing we can do here. This is just bigger and worse than anything I've ever seen. Then it occurs to him to try a cleansing of the house. And they go buy a bunch of stuff that they needed to cleanse the house. And they start walking through the house and cleansing it by burning sage and other smokes that supposedly these entities can't tolerate. And as they're upstairs smudging this place, the house catches on fire downstairs, and they barely escape with their life. The house burns to the ground. So now they're just really don't know what to say to the woman whose house has just been burned up. So they go over to her house where she's living with her mother and her kids and tell her about the house burning down, and she's elated. She says, great, couldn't be better. I got insurance. We're all covered. So they go through the process of contacting the insurance company, and it's a big plot of land. So they decide to build another house in a different location so that it won't be bothered with the portal and all the other entities have to be gone, because the house was destroyed completely. And then as she starts getting into the groove and this house gets built and everybody's happy as can possibly be, she starts getting sick.
And she gets sicker and sicker, and finally she goes to the family doctor, and after a couple of tests, he says, "Ma'am, you're pregnant." And the bad part is she hadn't been with a man in several years, so she says, "That can't be. It's impossible." And after a few visits with a different doctor, she says, "This doctor's goofy as heck." Anyway, turns out she really is pregnant, and she decides the impregnation came from a demonic entity. And the basis of the story then takes a whole different turn, and how this story ends, I really don't want to
speak
over the air.
Well,
because
it sounds riveting, that's for sure.
Yeah.
And what's so amazing is that you say you have no choice about your stories. Now, explain that. That is wild.
I was explaining to you before we were on the air, I actually began as a teenager, a young teenager in the 60s, dreaming Twilight Zone episodes. And I got so I write them down because they were good stories. And I just mail them all to Rod Serling. And at 2 years, I never heard a thing from him. Finally, I get a letter from Rod Serling, and it says, "You know, we really appreciate you sending these stories to us, but, you know, you're a young man, you're not represented, and frankly, we can't use them. But, you know, I'm so impressed with how you've done it. He said, I really would like to meet you. And if there's any chance that maybe we could give you an internship or something for the summer while you're out of college or something, we would sure love to meet you." So he had this phone number on this letter. And I think about it, oh, Jesus, you know, this might be a real opportunity. And, of course, this is back when, you know, Vietnam was raging and the draft was very popular. And, you know, so I'm afraid of losing my student status. But I thought, you know, I'm going to call this guy anyway. So I called him. Lady answers the phone, wants to know who I am. I tell her why I was calling. And I told her about this letter. And she goes, "Well, sir," she said, "I got some very bad news. Mr. Serling just died of cancer yesterday."
Oh, my goodness.
So I never got to meet the man, never got to join in his organization, and I immediately stopped dreaming these stories. But years and years later, when I was a banker up in Alaska, I started dreaming stories again, and they were just really detailed. So I was in a position that I couldn't get them out of my mind. They just would stay in my head all day long. So I finally started writing them down, and then as I did that, every night as I'd go to bed, I would dream a new chapter, one upon another, upon another, upon another. And I'd write down the basis of everything that I dreamt, and then I would go back and I'd fill in the, you know, I'd make up the verbiage for the story and the people and so forth. But it was just amazing as to what I dreamt and how it all turned into a story without me having any input. As far, you know, like I'm sure normal writers sit down and think, okay, what am I going to write about? And I haven't had any of that ever in my life. My fifth book, this one you're just talking about, just came out. And I had a whole bunch of stories that I had put into storage. And I just started about 7-8 years ago digging them out and getting some of them published and the better ones and so forth. The one that I just published, The House on Terminal Island, I dreamt that probably 9-10 months ago. It came to me over a 5-night stance, and then the story was done. And it's a shorter book than a lot of my others. I got some that are up to 500 pages. This one's only 200 pages. But, you know, the story tells itself out, and it ends, and that's that. So that's just the way my stories have come.
Well, and here you are, a banker, which most people would say, you know, conservative, logical, very careful, image, all of this. And here you are, writing ghost stories that you don't create yourself, you dream them. Now, do many people know about this?
Well, my close friends are. I have over the years shared my stories with my friends, and frankly, I've asked them to proofread them because I found that when you publish a book, the service you get from the publisher as far as proofreading is very poor.
Hmm.
My fourth book, which is a very good story about policemen and what the kind of things they run into that they can't talk about that are paranormal. It's a good story, but it turned out I didn't have enough proofreading, and it's riddled with errors and it's embarrassing. So a lot of my friends, I just bring five or six of them in. I say, here's a rough copy of the story. Go through it and proof it and mm-hmm. find the errors, and you know we'll fix it because you can't fix your own story. I tell you, you'll read a story you've written, you don't see any errors because your mind's skipping over stuff. So I just rely on a lot of friends, and they all know that's how I get my stories. I dream them.
So do you believe in ghosts?
Oh, absolutely. I not only believe in, I'm seeing them.
You've seen them.
Yep. I know that sounds stupid.
Well, not at all, but can you kind of tell us about one experience?
Well, let me think here a minute. Back in the 60s, when I was still going to college and got out of high school. I had a good friend who lived close by, and he had a sister who I was secretly in love with, you know. So anyway, they invited me over for a barbecue one night, and we had a nice time. It was, you know, just good teenage outing. And then she grabbed him by the arm. She says, "Come in the garage. I want to show you something." And I'm thinking, "Ooh, okay." Go into the garage, and there's a table set up with this game on it that I'd never seen in my life before. And about three of our friends were in there getting ready to play the game. It was the Ouija board. Mm-hmm. And I thought it was all a bunch of BS because they're moving this planchet around, and they're, you know they're moving it themselves. They're not, it's not something spiritual. Anyway, it starts spelling out stuff, and then it spelled out, if you know what a Ouija board is, it's got letters on it, and it actually spelled out, "Ron, stay out of the Army." And I'm looking at that, and I'm thinking, what?
And
I'm not on the board. I'm not even touching it. And I says, "Well, who is asking me to stay out of the Army?" And it wrote back, and it was my grandfather. It spelled out his name, first name, last name, and he'd been dead about 6 months. And it said, "Stay out of the Army, you'll be killed." Well, I actually got to a point that my grades weren't very good in school, and I said, "To heck with it." I went ahead and enlisted, and I actually enlisted in the Army. And in my enlistment program, I signed up to be a warrant officer, a helicopter pilot. So when I got out of basic training, they sent me to Fort Rucker, Alabama, where I became a pilot. And I was waiting to get my orders. And we'd been out partying the night before because we know we're going to be sent to Vietnam, and who knows what's going to happen to you there. So, but, you know, you're young and you're dumb and you don't care. Anyway, I was waiting to get my orders, so I go to bed that night. I wake up the next morning about 3 in the morning, got to use the latrine. So I get out of bed, and I walk into the hall, and standing there in the doorway is my grandfather. He said, "You stupid kid, I told you not to join the Army." And then he's gone, and I'm thinking, oh, it was something in my mind. Mm-hmm. And then I recalled the incident with the Ouija board. And so I go back to bed, and I wake up about 6 o'clock in the morning, getting ready to get up and get dressed. And standing at the foot of my bed is my father, and he was in it. My dad was a World War II veteran. He was injured during the war. And there he is in his World War II uniform. Now, my dad, at this point in time, had ballooned up to probably 250 pounds, but when he was in the military, he probably weighed, you know, skinny 165 or 70. And here he is in his military uniform, thin. And he looked at me and said, "Don't worry, son." He says, "You're not going to have to go. You're not going to have to go to war. I'll go for you." And then he's gone. And I'm thinking, oh, God, what goofy thoughts have I got here? So anyway, we go have chow, and then we go in and get our orders. And standing at the counter is a first sergeant. He says, "Schmidt, come over here. I want to talk to you." So I go over to him, and he goes, "Look," he says, "we got your orders here, but we've also got a request from the Red Cross for you to call this number." And he says, "I fear somebody in your family has died." So I made a call. And sure enough, Red Cross said, "You know, one of your parents has died, and we're sending requests to the military to have you sent home on a hardship leave, and you need to take care of business." Well, I didn't know which family member died, so I call home, no answer. I get home, and my parents' friends pick me up at the airport, and they tell me, "Ron, you know what's happened?" I said, "No, I just know that somebody died, and I don't know who." They said, "Well, first of all, it was your father. He died of a massive heart attack early yesterday. And your mother is very, very ill because of it. She's in the hospital." So, you know, I'm thinking to myself, was that really my father that I saw? You know, it was just weird. And it was just a weird sensation. But yet, it all worked out. I got a hardship discharge out of the Army. Never did have to go to active duty. I spent a long time in the reserves, but... You know, it was nothing that was stressful or anything that was going to cause me any harm. And then when I got out of the Army and got discharged, I got my first banking job. And one of my customers is a man that has two young children. He buys this old house in Pomona that used to be a boarding house. It had been built in the mid-1800s, and he wanted me to help him refurbish it and clean it up because he's going to move his family into it. And he was divorced, so he'd have his kids one weekend and his wife the next. And one of his kids was a very, very extremely smart kid. At about 6 years old, he could play the drums, he could play the piano, he could play all kinds of musical instruments, never having a lesson in his life. But this kid started telling us about weird stuff that he was experiencing, and one of them was people standing in his bedroom. And it turns out that we actually heard people talking in this kid's bedroom, but you'd open the door, there'd be nobody there. And, you know, that was kind of the beginning of me really getting involved into paranormal activity.
Well, Ron, you're filled with stories, that's for sure, and your stories have turned into 5 books, and your latest book is the title The House on Terminal Island, and this is Ronald Schmidt. Ron, tell us how to get your book.
Well, you can get it at any bookstore. You can go to Trafford Publishing, or you can go to my website, which is www.ghosts-around-us.com. And you can order it there, and I can send it to you. But probably the easiest way would be to go to either Trafford or to one of the major bookstores.
Well, Ron, you're a great storyteller. We appreciate you. And are you going to do more?
Oh, yeah. It's fun.
It's fun. Okay.
And I got to tell you, my friends have all nicknamed me Bullschmidt.
Bullschmidt. Okay. It sounds appropriate. Anyway, yeah. Ron, we thank you for being with us on Indie Book Publishing and this interview brought to everyone by Trafford Publishing. Thank you, Ron.
Thanks, Steve, for the call.
You've been listening to Indie Book Publishing with your host, Steve Jorgensen. Join us again next week at noon Eastern as Steve interviews another great author.